Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Philosophy in Action. I'm Greg Perkins, here with philosopher Dr. Diana Brickell, where we answer your question, applying rational principles to the challenges of real life. For those listening to the podcast, please join us live where there's a text chat to chime in with your follow-up questions and witty comments. The show airs Sunday at 8 a.m. Pacific, 9 a.m. Mountain, 10 a.m. Central, and 11 a.m. Eastern Time at philosophyinaction.com. At the site, you can also submit and vote on questions for upcoming shows and browse the archive of past shows. Now, with all of that out of the way, let's jump over to the star of the show, Dr. Diana Brickell.
Happy Sunday.
Happy Sunday, Arthur. So Greg is off cheering Tammy at a race, so he is not here, and Arthur has graciously agreed to step in. So welcome, everyone. Tell us what topics we have on tap this week.
We have a great set of questions on workplace diversity, accusations of date rape, evaluating romantic prospects, and more.
Yes, we have like a mildly heavy question, a really heavy question, and then something much lighter, and hopefully we will get to all of them. Folks, if you're listening live, you can post questions and comments in the text chat that's over at philosophyinaction.com/live.
Any news this week before we tackle the questions?
Actually, not really. One bit of news is there won't be a live broadcast next Sunday because I'm doing the Tough Mudder, which I'm super excited about. And so I'm not sure what Greg and I are going to do. I think we'll probably do something on Wednesday night or Thursday night or something like that. So we'll figure that out and get something going for that.
Sounds good.
Yeah. So that's about it. Let's go ahead and get started. Hang on. I'm trying to conga here. And there we go. I can never get it right the first time.
Question one, workplace diversity. Is the lack of racial and sexual diversity in the workplace a problem? Lately, there have been a lot of discussions about the lack of diversity in the tech industry. I've been asked to fill out surveys indicating my gender and race, which I politely refuse to complete. I don't see how my sex or color of my skin impacts my work as an engineer. Some companies promote diversity statistics in their blog and claim that they're working to improve workplace diversity. In late July, Pinterest posted a similar blog entry and went even further by explicitly setting goals to hire women and people of, quote, unrepresented ethnic backgrounds, unquote. Is this lack of diversity a problem in an industry? If so, what kinds of measures should be used to address it?
Okay, so here's my basic view, and then we'll flesh this out a little bit. Racism and sexism are not problems that are completely fixed in America today. There is this problem of unconscious bias which persists, and that's basically where people prefer what's familiar to them, even though this is among people who would never be overtly racist and sexist. They don't have any, you know, overtly racist and sexist beliefs, but they simply, you know, they're more comfortable with what's familiar, which is true for everybody on all issues. But the solution to that is not the kind of diversity measures that are touted by progressives and progressive companies. Those kinds of measures, they often discriminate unjustly against white males. They require hiring less qualified candidates. And they do, in fact, fail to address the root problem here. And so my basic view is, look, if we're going to address this problem, and I think it's worth companies should, for their own self-interest, should wish to address it, we're going to need some more clever solutions. We're going to need some more difficult solutions than just, oh, let's hire more women, let's hire more underrepresented minorities.
Yeah, so let's start by talking about what makes this diversity view plausible.
Yeah, you can actually get us started on this, Arthur, because I thought you had some really good comments on this in our production meeting.
Yeah, so I think that the problem is that this diversity approach is justified, especially nowadays, by appeal to data that says that workplaces that are diverse are more productive, et cetera, right? When you have more women on the board, it shows there's a lot of data that says, oh, hey, these companies are performing better in various respects. There's more workplace satisfaction when there are more female managers. And I think there's also an important proxy in there somewhere, right? There are a lot of different kinds of ideas or skill sets or outlooks that tend to be highly correlated with specific demographic subsets like women or different racial groups and so on. So it's not really the diversity of gender or sex or skin color that's valuable, but that there's this, that by promoting those kinds of things, you end up getting all of these other positive effects of diversity of ideas and so on. And as a result, I think people end up being able to push this diversity viewpoint because they can point to these positive effects.
Yeah, and it's not unreasonable for people to nod their head and say, yeah, I've actually experienced that, because I personally have. When I was a web programmer in my first job after college at a web design firm in Santa Monica, I was the only woman besides the receptionist when I was hired. So basically I was the only woman on the kind of like production staff, like the substantial staff when I was hired. And the culture of like all men, of actually a variety of racial backgrounds, but all men, was pretty juvenile and pretty unprofessional, right? I mean, that's like you get a bunch of young men together and it's not surprising that that would be the case, right? And what happened was as more women were hired in design roles, in other coordinative roles and so on, the culture changed. It became more mature. It became more kind. It became more friendly. And that was a good thing, and everybody liked that. So
you're such a sexist, Diana.
I know, but it was true. It was true. And it was for me, it wasn't super awkward being the only woman, because I tend to actually prefer that, oddly, because I went to an all-girl school. I tend to prefer the company of men. But it was, I liked it better, too, once more women were hired. That was a good thing. Now, again, as I suggested in my opening comments here, the problem is of a kind of low-level implicit racism or sexism. It's not overtly refusing to hire blacks or women, but subconsciously people will oftentimes feel more comfortable with people who are similar to them. So if you have a bunch of white men working in an office, they might gravitate towards hiring yet another white man. And there also can be implicit assumptions here that men are, let's say, men or whites are more skilled, they're more educated, they're more capable, and so on. And these are not, again, they're not overtly racist. Like, the person is not racially biased in some kind of clear way, but they just have these background assumptions that they haven't quite checked, and which are still influencing their opinions. And as a result, one of the results of these kinds of implicit biases is that men or whites can be preferred in hiring or promotion to women and or minorities. And so the result of that is essentially racist or sexist, right? Even if the people are not, they're decent people, they're not trying to be racist or sexist. The result of that is that more qualified minorities or women get passed over because, it's just not quite a good fit. But if the person who's hiring doesn't articulate exactly what the issue is, they might not realize that it's implicit racial or sexual bias.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting though, if you have a particular firm, or I don't know if there are industries like this, but if you have a particular firm where the employees are heavily dominated by women or racial minorities, and they tend to hire on bases like you suggested, what's more familiar to them, and so they end up hiring more women or racial minorities. No one ever seems to bat an eye or think that that's a problem.
Yeah, but they should, because it is still a problem. I mean, if you're a male nurse, you know, you could have a real problem getting a job, even if you're really, really good. Or just think about the biases against, let's say if you're a man and you want to be an elementary school teacher. Right? Like, dude, are you a pedophile? Like, what's up with that? Like, people have these weird views about that, even though that's a perfectly legitimate profession for a man. So I do think that points to one of the problems with the diversity outlook, is they're only seeing one half of this, and they're not seeing the problems with implicit bias that are all over the place and work in reverse in other professions.
Well, right. And I think that actually exposes that the actual motivation of a lot of people who are trying to push diversity agendas is not really to counter this implicit racism. That's just a rationalization. That's a plausible argument that they're able to make, because if they really were worried about implicit racism, they would be trying to address it across the board. And not only that, but in more effective ways.
Right. Well, I think they have a certain worldview about and we've certainly seen this in so many instances, about like what constitutes racism. And it can't possibly be that an oppressed minority can be racist against the majority. And that's just philosophically wrong. That there's this, it's part of this three languages of politics. They have this oppressor versus the oppressed narrative in their head, and it comes out in a particular kind of way where they're only looking at like overall culture, dominant groups, and there's a kind of no, I wouldn't want to put it in motivational terms so much, because I can't speak to people's motivations, but it certainly comes out as a certain kind of blindness and a certain kind of commitment to only seeing certain kinds of bias. And that's obviously dangerous and wrong and destructive.
Sure, I agree. And I think that it's actually somewhat ironic and sad that, because I do think it is true that, or at least I'm inclined to believe it's true, that women and racial minorities tend to get more of the raw end of the deal here when it comes to implicit racism and whatever racism and sexism still exists in our culture. But these policies that are created, the agendas that are pursued, actually end up being even more destructive for those groups. But I think we'll get to that later, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I do want to mention that this kind of implicit bias, this is one of the ways that these kind of old boy networks are perpetuated today. And there was actually a really interesting example of this that sort of came to light a couple of years ago. And this was in NFL head coaches. So a couple of years ago, there was not a single black head coach. There was lots of black assistant coaches. There's obviously a lot of black players who go into coaching, that kind of thing. And this is not because the owners, who are a bunch of old white men, basically, for the most part, it's not because, pardon me, it's not because they were overtly racist. I mean, maybe some of them were, but certainly not all of them were. And even the ones who are racist, like, they really want to win, right? That's their top priority. So, you know, there's lots of them who would go, yeah, I don't like, I won't say that there's lots of them. There might be some NFL owners who wouldn't wish to have a black man over for dinner, but would totally hire him as a head coach if that's what's going to be the winning strategy. So, anyway, the point is that there's economic self-interest in play here in a really big way. And yet, there was not a single black head coach. And this is likely because these owners were just going with what was more comfortable. And the good black coaches were just not on their radar. They weren't part of their sort of social set, their, you know, who they were interacting with, that kind of thing. But what happened then, the NFL saw this and saw, look, this is a problem. And so they instituted a policy whereby you had to interview, I think it was like, at least one, or maybe it was even at least three potential coaches if you were interviewing for a head coach position. And not a big fan of this policy, about the way that they went about it, but it was extremely effective. And in a very, very short time, like within 3 years, there were two black head coaches competing against each other at the Super Bowl. And I just thought, like, this is actually a really clear case where if you just gave somebody the chance to come in and sit down and have this interview with you and interact with you one-on-one, that sort of old boy network got destroyed very, very quickly. But that certainly existed, and I think the fact that that you then saw the two black head coaches competing against each other at the Super Bowl indicates that, yeah, there was a genuine problem here. There was an overlooking of talent here that we got over that.
Yeah, and I think that for those of us who are against these kinds of diversity policies or agendas, to call them sexist or racist in themselves, while that might be true, I don't necessarily see that as rhetorically effective, right? Their advocates don't really see them that way. They think that they're fighting racism and sexism.
Right, right. And again, this is partly, I mean, they can point to cases like this, cases like the NFL head coach case, and they can say, look, you know, look at what this did. And and again, they do have this worldview whereby the dominant sort of the dominant players in the culture can't possibly be subject to racism or sexism, and that's unfortunate, that's really wrong in their view. And I think the question about how to combat that, I think, is a really interesting one, and I don't have an answer to that off the top of my head. Maybe that would be a great question to submit to the queue.
Yeah.
Okay, so I think the next point we've, oh, Jesus. Okay, we're going to have to pause here, Arthur.
Okay.
Because you see who is in the chat.
Yep.
And, okay, so hang on a second. We're just going to, we're at a good pause point. We're going to talk about the problems with diversity hiring in a second. And I'm going to make a note of the time. And it'll be time to talk to Homeland Security again in a little bit, which I've already done just recently. Okay, sorry, hang on. Because this hadn't happened in a couple weeks, I was not prepared and logged in a proper way. But I'll do that.
You'll let me know if there's anything I can do to help here.
Yes. Yes. I have to remember exactly what it was that I did before. Delightful. Delightful, delightful. Oh, and like here, he's just, he's entering and leaving the conversation, which is, not super helpful. Oh, you know what, Arthur? You know what you could do? Because this will actually be important for the Homeland Security, is to take screenshots.
Already done.
Okay.
Who are you talking to? Come on.
Oh.
Actually, it only took a screenshot of his particular thing, so I'll just take a screenshot of the whole
page.
Yeah.
God, why is it that I can't? Okay. No.
Can you pause the recording of the show or the show itself?
No, no. I know. I'll take out the relevant section.
Okay. He's back.
No, I can't. Yeah, sorry, Tom. I can't ignore it because it's too disgusting. Oh. And God damn it. Sorry. I'm completely forgotten how to do this.
Are you trying to IP block him?
Yeah, which I don't think. At the very least, I wish to be able to delete his things. Okay, so you've got screenshots of this?
Correct.
I assume you will get screenshots as soon as they come in.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So I now have this window open, so I will be able to do that. Okay, 9:15 to 9:19. Sorry, Tom, and anybody else who's listening live. Okay, so here we go again.
All right.
Yeah, go ahead.
So let's actually talk about some of the problems with diversity hiring.
Yeah, so I covered some of this in a discussion of the harm of anti-discrimination laws, and you can listen to that. That's available in the in the archives, so you can listen to that there. One problem is that this kind of diversity hiring, like with anti-discrimination laws, in fact, can lead to quotas. And Arthur, you had some interesting comments on that.
Yeah, so Twitter actually has recently published a blog post about their own diversity goals. And even though they don't explicitly state that they're going to have quotas, it seems unavoidable that they're going to have to do just that.
So I went and looked at this post just this morning, and I was like, how can you say these are not quotas? They are, right? They're explicitly quotas. So they say, quote, here are the representation goals we've set for 2016. Increase women overall to 35%. Increase women in tech roles to 16%. Increase women in leadership roles to 25%. Increase underrepresented minorities overall to 11%. Increase underrepresented minorities in tech roles to 9%. Increase underrepresented minorities in leadership roles to 6%. Close quote. So these representation goals, like, that's just newspeak for quotas. That's like when you are giving definite numbers of this is how much, like this is the percentage we want, that's a quota.
That's true, but keep in mind that this is a more politic way of doing that, right? They're not saying here we're going to actually hire such and such percentages when we've got some kind of candidate pool or what have you, or that we're going to fill so many openings with such and such percentages. They're just saying these are our goals and we're going to take some unspecified steps in order to achieve them. So they will argue that they will still be able to hire perfectly qualified or like the best qualified candidates and still reach these goals.
My head hurts, and not just because I have a migraine this morning.
Yeah, but I mean,
and it's the particularly it's the unspecified way in which they're doing that, and you can talk to that a little bit. I know about how that actually functions.
Yeah, I mean, so one way is that they have these numerous job recs that now explicitly call for, quote, diversity candidates, unquote. And I think that definitely discourages qualified non-diversity candidates from applying. So,
like, what's the point? Like, because it takes effort, it takes work to apply. And what's the point if I know you're looking for a woman or a minority and I'm a white guy?
Right. And I know that Twitter used to rationalize their diversity agendas by the supposed data that proves the benefits of women in leadership roles, racial minorities, and so on. But it seems like they have dropped that pretense. I noticed no mention of any of these justifications in the blog post. And frankly, I don't think it's going to be hard to guess what the consequences are going to be. And you know, somewhat as an aside, I think it's really dangerous for Twitter to be trying to fix this kind of social problem when, as a business, they're currently really suffering. So I really wish, because obviously I care very strongly about Twitter's success, and I really wish that they would focus their attention on things that actually matter to their business than these amorphous diversity agendas that are aimed at making themselves feel good about rectifying social ills.
Right, right.
And you know, what's particularly frustrating about that is that Twitter as a platform, like the actual product that they create, is responsible for enabling revolutions that overthrow oppressive regimes around the world. Like, you don't think they've created enough social good? Like, it's ridiculous that they think that it's their job to fix various kinds of imbalances in representations of gender and race in the tech industry.
Yeah, I mean, it's one thing to say, look, we need to adopt X policy because we see that our culture is actually harmed by, you know, having too many, you know, too narrow of a type of person, right? Which could be race or age or sex or personality or background or all kinds of other things. Right. There wouldn't be this focus on age and sex, and that, or not age and sex, on race and sex. That would make sense to say, hey, look, we want to be a better business. Here's what we're going to do. But no, that's not really what I'm seeing here.
Yeah. And honestly, like, I don't really see a lot of this implicit sexism or racism at Twitter. I mean, over the years, I feel like actually some of the people that I've regarded as the most responsible, the people who take the most pride in their work, that I've most enjoyed working with, just by complete happenstance, have been women. I have this list, which is the exact opposite of a shit list. It's like people that I actually really admire and love working with.
It's like
and so
a bacon
on.
List.
And it's funny. I add people to it as I recognize them as just really remarkable individuals, especially in a professional context. And the vast majority of them happen to be women. I don't see that we're having trouble getting really good, qualified women into Twitter. So the idea that we think that this is some kind of huge problem, I don't know. It seems unusual to me.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And in far as these amorphous ways in which these diversity goals are met, one of the things that Greg reported in our production meeting, because all three of us met, which was super fun, was that at HP, they said, oh, look, we take the best applicants at the door, right? We're this is how we're not going to compromise quality, is we're going to get this pool of applicants and we're going to choose the best out of that. But who was at the door, in other words, who got into the pool of applicants, was already filtered by race and sex and by age. And this he thought was somewhat less than honest. I would agree with that. Okay, but I want to talk more about some of these practical consequences. So one of the obvious ways is that better qualified white males will be overlooked or discouraged from applying, which is that's unjust to them because they will be unemployed or underemployed. And it's also really harmful to the business as well because they are not getting the best possible employee.
Right. And my friend Jared told me that he had recently heard a piece on NPR where they were interviewing graduates of various coding boot camps, and noticeably more men had a harder time getting jobs than women. And it's as though it never occurred to anybody that this could be the possible result of some of these diversity agendas. I mean, I don't think that women are inherently any less capable than men at software engineering positions. But the idea that women should have an easier time than men finding these jobs, I mean, to have that kind of disparity makes no sense.
Yeah. And I think that kind of disparity, it's not long before that creates resentment, not just towards the advocates of these diversity programs, but towards the beneficiaries of those programs, even if those women and minorities wanted to succeed purely on their own merits. And that's not good. That kind of it's not class warfare, but it's similar. It's you know, sex warfare, racial warfare, like that kind of resentment. That's not how you create a inclusive, tolerant, welcoming society where you welcome people's inessential differences.
I agree.
More than that, and this is something I discussed in the discussion of anti-discrimination laws, is that these kinds of policies, they create doubts about the competence of all women and all ethnic minorities, even those who are highly skilled and capable. And this is certainly something that doctors and so on have noticed, you know, black doctors and something have noticed that they have to work so much harder to prove that they are competent. And in part, that's because of affirmative action programs.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, so ironically, it achieves the opposite in terms of the social or cultural effect of what they're hoping to achieve. It's very sad.
Right. I would agree.
So with that having been said, what kind of solutions might companies adopt to address the problem of implicit bias rather than these common diversity initiatives?
Yeah, you know, I think there's a tendency amongst advocates of free markets to say that, well, look, the free market will root out these problems, right? It'll root out inefficiency. And undoubtedly, free markets help, and they often help tremendously, particularly in cases of obvious bias. And that's because consumers can boycott companies that have racist and sexist policies. Hey, Arthur, if you're going to type, you're going to need to mute because I can hear you're typing like crazy.
Ah, sorry about that.
Yeah, that's all right. Okay, so one of the reasons the free market works is because consumers can boycott companies that have racist and sexist policies. Better workers can go, I'm a white man. I know you'd want to hire me, but screw you. I don't want to work in a place that's racist and sexist. I'm going to go work elsewhere. But the implicit bias is something else. That's hard to see. It's really hard for outsiders to see. It's even hard to see in oneself. And so, you know, how easy is that going to be to identify the companies that are operating on that standard of, on, are operating under implicit bias? And moreover, what we might see in a free market is companies trying to counter that kind of implicit bias with very wrong-headed programs like what we're seeing in spades today. And they're doing this purely of their own accord. The government is not forcing them to do this. So, you know, the free market doesn't always end up with exactly the right answer.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think another thing that needs to guide our thinking about this is that we need to recognize that individuals may self-select professions that don't result in even distributions across all possible demographic axes. And this could be because of inherent biological differences, like physical strength, right? You're not necessarily going to see women in, evenly represented in jobs that require a certain amount of physical ability and strength, or maybe even certain kinds of psychological differences. So even though it's perfectly legitimate for a man to be an elementary school teacher, you might see more women in those roles because they require more of a nurturing disposition, which is more readily found among women. You know, again, there are biological reasons for this. So certainly there are going to be there's going to be lots of variation among people and so on, but I think you're still going to see natural self-selection in these areas. And I don't think it's right that we should think that there should be just the same number of women working on oil rigs as men, or that there should be exactly the same number of, male nurses or male babysitters.
Right. Yeah, and it works both ways. Or, you know, men and women in tech. Like, it's not as if there's some ideal number. Like, this is the number of women who should be in tech. Who knows, right? What you want to do is give people the option so that if women want to study science, they can do that without feeling overly burdened. You want to have it, if women want to become software engineers, they can do that without feeling like they've got to climb so much harder than similarly intelligent and dedicated men.
Yeah.
And that's part of obviously what quotas ignore, those kinds of factors.
And they really sweep the issue under the rug.
Right. Of individual choices. Yeah.
Right.
And in part because I think they don't recognize those. They see those, any individual choices that people make, as the product of social forces. And we obviously have to, change. It's this kind of very Marxist view. We have to, restructure the society so that more women are wanting to go in tech in the first place. So very practically, what I would actually practically recommend that companies do is to adopt a policy to conceal personal qualities as much as possible in the early stages of the hiring process. So resumes should be reviewed blindly without any name or other information that identifies the person by race or by sex. And that, in fact, that's not perfect. Right. There's lots of, sometimes that's not possible. Sometimes you're hiring from within, those kinds of things. But that can have dramatic effects. And that's actually been seen in the rise in the percentage of women in orchestras due to blind auditions. It's a huge difference in terms of how many women get into the final stages if you have blind auditions initially or not. That makes a huge difference.
Yeah. And by the time that an individual has gotten to a phone interview or an on-site interview, it's like that person has now become more of an individual. And I think that various biases are less likely to be a factor, especially when the employers are basically honest and they're not explicitly or secretly racist, right? It helps to overcome some of the effects of implicit biases.
Right, because it's one thing just to be trying to sort through resumes, trying to pick out the ones that look appealing, but it's another thing by the time you have this one-on-one conversation with somebody and you encounter them as an actual real person. I just think there's a difference there, and the implicit bias is much more likely to show up in those sorting resume stage than in the individual one-on-one interviews.
I think there are lots of studies that actually show that, right? Like exactly the same resume, but with a different name that implies a different race. I don't know the accuracy of these studies, but at least the rhetoric is that if you have a more ethnic-sounding name, you're less likely to even get an interview.
Right. I mean, it could be, I mean, think about my current legal last name, right? If somebody doesn't know how to pronounce that, which they wouldn't unless they, you know, unless they know people with that same last name, if they don't know how to pronounce that, that can just, it can feel awkward to them, like having to ask and having to have that conversation. And it can just be like, well, why not go with this other person? You know, that's, it's Joe Smith. I know how to pronounce his name. So there can even be small frictions like that can make a difference.
Sure.
Another thing that I think people, just individuals, should do is to be aware of the weaknesses of one's own culture and one's own subculture and the strengths of other cultures and other subcultures. And so the idea here is to actively seek out strengths and make use of them. So don't just be blind. Don't just be thinking, well, like the way I do things, the way my culture does things, that's obviously the right way to do things. No, like look a little bit more broadly. See some of the downsides of some of the you know, tendencies if you get a bunch of women together, get a bunch of men together, or of sort of standard American culture, and that people with who were raised in different countries and raised in different cultures might be able to bring something to the table that we don't have. So I think that's really important. And that's true also for personality differences. It's not just that you want to learn to tolerate people with personality differences, but to appreciate what they bring to the table. Ultimately, I think people need to work to notice their own biases, particularly where in the position where they're hiring. And they need to be aware of their assumptions, not just about race or sex, but also about all of these things, right? Style, address, personality traits, outside interests, cultural background, all of those kinds of things.
Yeah, and I think that there's a really important deeper point here about these implicit biases. And just for example, something that I've really had to deal with a lot in my professional life is that people very readily will believe, because of experience and what's prevalent in our culture, that someone who is direct is also an abrasive asshole who just runs roughshod over others and their opinions. And it's really easy for someone to believe that, right? Because that, you know,
there's a lot of
common
people who are
failure
like that.
Mode. Yeah. It's a common failure mode for people who are direct and who are forthright, who have strong opinions and are willing to argue to back them up and so on. And so people with these kinds of assertive personalities, you know, can oftentimes be thought, and I think it is in just as much a discriminatory way, that, well, you get what I'm saying. We have to be aware of things like that, especially because things like that do not get a lot of attention in our culture.
Yeah. Yeah. And one of the benefits of studying personality theory is noticing that the way that other people are, on the one hand, it can be irritating, right? And it still might be irritating, but you can also say, oh, but look, because of this other quality, because of this difference from me, they bring something else to the table. So, and also there is this tendency to interpret other people's behavior through the lens of your own personality or through the lens of your own culture. And so if you study that, if you pay attention to that, you can realize that, oh no, their motives actually must be substantially different. This person who's being direct and assertive with me, that's not actually communicating to me that they don't give a crap about my opinion. They're just wanting to be very clear and honest about what theirs is, and then they do actually want to hear mine. Okay, I'll speak up. So that's the kind of thing that people need to do.
Yeah, I only care about your opinion if you're fact-oriented and you're trying to get at the truth.
So. Yeah.
All right, so what's your take-home point?
So the standard approach to diversity in the workplace is wrong and destructive to companies and potential employees. The problem of implicit bias based on race and sex is real, but more subtle and honest measures than diversity hiring are required to overcome that. And I will add, what I've said about here's some things that companies can do, I actually really think that if people want really good solutions here, they need to go look at the psychological literature on this stuff. Like there's a lot of people doing really interesting work on this kind of implicit bias and how to overcome it. And that's the kind of research that if you were an owner of a company or a manager or hiring, that's the kind of thing you would wish to go do.
Yeah. So I don't see any follow-up questions in the chat, but there is an issue that we discussed briefly in our production meeting. I don't know if you think we have time to discuss it, but it has to do with there's a certain kind of implicit elitism that is part of this idea that we need more women in tech.
Go ahead.
That tech is somehow inherently superior to other forms or to other careers. And I think that there's a really big problem there, right? When we talk about how there aren't enough women or minorities or whatever in the sciences, well, they're doing something else. Is it to say that those other things are worse? Are humanities worse than the sciences, if, for example, that's where they are? So it's almost like there's this implicit racism or sexism that causes people to judge science and tech as better in the first place because, oh, well, that's where the men are, so that must be the better discipline. And now let's make sure that all the women can get in there too. So there's a lot of, I think, really fuzzy thinking and kind of muddled views about all of these issues. And I think that's definitely a problem worth addressing.
Absolutely. I agree. Hang on a second. Yeah, I think, and it's funny because as somebody who, I started off as a math major and ended up in philosophy and I've done computer programming, I can go both ways, right, in terms of going in the humanities or in the sciences. And there sometimes is this feeling of that I've had that I then immediately dismiss because it's wrong, but this feeling of in these conversations about how we need more women in tech and science and all these STEM fields, of the sense of guilt. Like, here, I didn't do the proper thing that I should have done as, like, an assertive, smart woman. I should have gone into the sciences. Like, dude, no. Like, that's ridiculous. Right? I should have done what I most wanted to do. And I think that there's definitely issues of, look, pay and so on, right? And how interesting the work is and those kinds of issues that we should definitely pay attention to, because if women are getting kind of ghettoed into fields that are low paying because that's sort of the easy route for them to go, and there's lots of them that would like to go into the sciences but there's too much friction there, that kind of thing. Those are legitimate issues. But in general, I don't think that one should have the attitude of, well, like, if you can do the sciences, you ought to go do that. Or if you can do tech, you ought to do tech.
But Flo mentions in the chat, I think it's a class issue here. Tech jobs are the high-paying jobs. No one says there should be more women construction workers. And I think there's definitely a certain truth to that, except that you have to remember, and this is not against what Flo is saying, but it's not necessarily the case that a job is better because it pays more, or that even a profession is better because, by and large, it might pay more than some other profession.
Right.
Like, money is one factor, for sure, but really there is no quote-unquote better profession. I think every individual needs to figure out for him or herself which one is the most appropriate given their specific context, their interests, their passions, and so on.
Sorry. Yet another problem. Sorry. Getting distracted here. And there was a thought I had and I've now completely forgotten it. Oh, one of the things that actually really matters to women is flexibility in hours, because women are, for better or worse, right? Maybe this shouldn't be so, but women are generally the ones responsible for kids and childcare, and flexible hours might mean more than having that super difficult, super rewarding, super intense, super high paying career.
Right. All right. I'm not seeing any other questions. So I think it's time for a reminder about the tip jar.
KPOM had a question about market failure and basically whether I was raising the issue of market failure because, I accidentally deleted the relevant comment there about because basically that the free market won't necessarily solve this problem. Look, I think that you'd have to ask me a separate question about market failure in the submit that to the queue, I think, because I want to go look at the concept. I have a feeling that there's a big fat package deal in that concept of market failure. Markets are not designed to fix every social ill. They're not designed to always be perfectly just and result in the best possible outcome. And so it's perfectly possible to say, look, the market alone will not fix this problem. People need to do some other stuff too. And that's absolutely fine. That's not a reason for government intervention. Not at all.
Yeah, I agree with that. And, you know, it's funny though, when we say the market will fix it or won't fix it and we have to do other kinds of things, there's a sense in which the market will fix it, right? Like our talking about it and figuring out like how companies can overcome problems of implicit bias and so on, like that is a market solution, right? The idea is that it's just not being done by government force. The point is, sure, we have to do more careful thinking about it and that it's not just a cold economic calculus that might prompt companies to make these changes. And maybe we need to bring some kind of additional social awareness to certain kinds of issues. But I think ultimately you could probably still characterize it as a market solution. Like you certainly don't need government intervention or government regulations to fix these problems.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Maybe now it's time for a reminder about the tip jar.
I hope so. So Philosophy in Action Radio, not just a live show, but the podcast too, is available to anyone free of charge. That's because we want to spread rational principles far and wide, and we do that with every show to thousands of listeners. But we can't accomplish that alone. We do rely on the support of our fans. So if you value our work, please do contribute to our tip jar. You can visit philosophyinaction.com/support to send money online or via the mail. We suggest $5 per episode or $20 per month, but any amount is welcome. You can also create a recurring monthly tip via PayPal, Dwolla, or your bank's bill pay. Then you don't need to remember, and you get free access to Philosophy in Action's premium content, and we really appreciate that regular support. Again, you can do that at philosophyinaction.com/support. And sorry, folks, but we have another pause here. I'm taking screenshots to report this to security. And I can't, KPM, I'm very sorry, but I can't tell which one is you. And so you might try logging in under a different name because I don't know who to ban at this point. And in fact, what I'm going to do is just disconnect you both. There we go. Okay. Conga, here we go.
Question 2, accusations of date rape. What's the proper response to an accusation of date rape in the absence of hard evidence? When faced with this kind of serious accusation within a social group, what is the proper judgment and course of action? If the accuser seems believable, should the accused be shunned or banned from the group? Should private warnings be given to group members? Does refusing to engage in any public discussion of the matter constitute silent assent to the crime? Or should judgment and action be reserved until further evidence comes to light?
So this is very abstract, and what I want to do is concretize it a little bit because that's going to actually really matter. So imagine that Joe and Mary are part of your monthly book club, and it's a book club of friends. You know, you guys know each other, you get together, you hang out outside of the book club, that kind of thing. And Joe and Mary go out on a few dates, and then, you know, after not too much time, Mary comes to you and she's super duper upset. She tells you that Joe raped her. And you're the leader in this club, so, you know, you have some decisions about what you want to do. And there's some really grave, grave danger here of making some serious mistakes. So just two obvious ones. You could just accept Mary's story at face value, tell everyone in the group that Joe raped her, you know, tell it online, kick him out of the group and so on. But the problem is she might be lying or she might be confused in some way. She might think that something constituted rape when it didn't actually. And if that's the case, then you've done this grave, grave injustice to Joe and you've deprived yourself of the company of a good person. And then you've got this potentially dangerous person who's still in your midst. Mary might throw another bomb into the group, particularly if she is willfully dishonest in her rape accusation. So, like, that's a problem if you're accepting Mary's story at face value. But it's no better to reject her story as a fabrication because, well, surely we all know that Joe is a good guy, right? Then in that case, if you're rejecting her story offhand or out of hand, then you're going to drive out Mary, potentially a very good person, just for speaking the truth, and you will be left with a rapist in your midst who might repeat his crime. So, you know, that's not a super good idea either. So the point that I want to make here is that it's impossible to make any kind of blanket judgment. It's wrong to even lean in one direction or the other. Any kind of assumptions here about who is likely telling the truth based on simply accuser versus accused are those kind of assumptions are all dangerous. Everything here depends on the particulars. And if you want to make a rational decision about what to do, then you're going to need lots and lots and lots more facts.
So as a leader of the group, what should you do?
Okay. I've got how many things? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 6 things. Okay. So first of all, recognize that you have a major, major conflict here. Mary and Joe are not going to hug each other and forgive. They're not even going to tolerate each other. So this group is only going to be able to accommodate one of those two going forward. And you really don't want the person in the group to be the liar or the rapist. So you're going to need to ascertain the truth, and you're the leader of the group, so that's going to fall upon you. Pause here for a second. Oh, I'm so annoyed that I have to deal with this again. Okay, resuming once again. Second point, getting to the facts of the matter is going to be extremely, extremely difficult. You need to approach this really gingerly. You need to be as scrupulously objective as possible. There is this common tendency to simply side with either the accuser or the accused, but that's a really dangerous form of bias. You need to focus on the facts of this situation. You need to be aware of the pull of emotions.
I think especially with number two, I think you have to be very careful about any kind of bias that you have because of knowing Mary or Joe better.
Right.
So if you happen to be closer to one of the two, that is not a reason on its own to necessarily believe that person. The other person may very well be ultimately more trustworthy, and you just don't know that about that person yet because you're not as close to them.
Right, right. Absolutely. Third, you need to talk to both Mary and Joe in detail about what happened that night. They need to understand at the outset why you are asking for this. This is not salacious gossip, but an attempt to get at the facts and to be just about things. Now, I think there's this tendency to imagine here that the guilty party will have his or her story all laid out and all perfect, but that's not always the case. Often, a person is going to admit to the relevant facts even if they don't admit to the offense. And this has actually been my actual experience. So the person tries, they don't say explicitly, yes, I did X, Y, and Z, but they try to justify themselves. And that justification is itself an admission. So they're basically trying to excuse their behavior or say, here's why it was okay. And that is in and of itself very clearly, oh, look, you know, that was rape, or, oh, look, you were lying. So Joe might say something like, well, sure, she told me to stop, but she didn't push me off, so I was almost done, so I just kept going, right? Or, you know, she fell asleep in my bed after a few too many drinks, so I thought I might as well, right? Like, dude, that wasn't an invitation, that wasn't consent, that was rape, right? And Joe, in those kind of cases, would never admit, yes, this was rape, but he has in fact admitted to raping Mary. Or Mary might say, well, I didn't really want him to go that far, and, you know, he just should have asked. Well, like, honey, it was your job to say no, and you didn't, and so it's not rape. Sorry. Or she might say something, well, look, like, we were both drunk, and he really took advantage. And again, the question is, did he know that you were not consenting or that you didn't want this? Did you actually not consent? Are you just regretting it? Like, these are problems. These are indications that there was potentially a horrible miscommunication, but Joe did not rape you.
Right.
Okay, fourth point. You need to consider the characters of Mary and Joe. Have they ever lied before? Are there other instances of boundary crossing or bad judgment? And again, you might know one better than the other. Arthur, I really like your warning about that. And so one of the things you can do is consult other members of the group who you trust, because you might not know of things, bad things that one or the other has done, but other people in the group might know. And ultimately, unfortunately, if the facts aren't clear, if one of them doesn't admit to it, then you might need to make a judgment largely based on character. And that's unfortunate, but there's not, you know, that might be what you have to do.
Yeah, and I'd like to add here that when you consult other people in the group, you definitely want to do this in private. It can be too easy for this to turn into a rumor or gossip mill if you do too much stuff in public. Definitely don't do this online.
Yes. Facebook is not the place to discuss this. Yeah. Right. There should pretty much be no public discussion of this unless it gets reported to the police, and then you can simply report those facts, and that should give people enough warning. But yeah, there should be no public lynching in either direction.
And moreover, whatever conversations you have, whether with Mary or Joe or with anybody else in the group, I strongly recommend in-person, face-to-face conversations, because you're going to gain a lot of information from being able to assess people's body language, their facial expressions, the intonation in their voice when they say things. That is all going to give you so much rich information about people's veracity and the state of their knowledge in a way that pure text information or conversation is just going to lose.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Although in my experience, I have had people basically admit to the crime by in email.
Sure.
Just incredibly dumb. I mean, yeah, but nonetheless.
I'm not saying that can't also have its value in the sense that it provides you with a written record of an interaction. And for anyone who knows me, they know what a big fan I am of records of all things all the time. But, you know, there, I suppose, in a sense, competing values here. You know, on the one hand, records are great. On the other hand, that's not necessarily advantageous for all dimensions of fact gathering.
Right. Now, if you are in a one-party state, it means that you can record conversations with only the consent of one party, and that can be yourself. So that can be another way of getting a record in an in-person conversation.
Sure.
Okay, so that was point number four about considering their characters. Point number five is you need to be very careful of the strength of your evidence and of the possibility of mistakes here. So you need to always be on alert, I would say, with both people until the facts are known for certain, and that might never happen. And you're going to need to be willing to change your mind if you realize that you were wrong, and you should try not to do anything irrevocable until you are completely certain. Just be aware of your kind of epistemic standing here. And just because, let's say, you've decided to ask Joe to leave the group and you're going to keep Marion doesn't mean that Joe is definitely a rapist. There's a difference between those judgments. Six, as for warning others, again, public online conversation, I do not recommend in any way, shape, or form. As for who you warn in third parties or within your group, I think that depends on your relationship with those third parties. What kind of risks are they facing? What is your level of certainty? In some cases, I would say you really ought to warn. If this person is your close friend and she's about to go on a date with Joe and you're quite certain that he did something bad to Mary, she deserves a warning. But in other cases, it would be best to remain silent. And drawing those lines can be really, really difficult.
Yeah, and I think Diana, you and I even talked about how just the fact of the mere accusation might be sufficient if the person whom you're issuing the warning to is a very close friend.
Right. Right.
You might say, like, hey, I don't know whether to trust Joe or Mary, but, you know, just so you know, this is an accusation that has been made, and just be alert, keep your wits about you, and that's hard to do because it can really color the date.
But. Yeah, that depends how risk averse somebody is, you know, your friend that you're warning. And in my case, I would always rather know. And I can manage the risk. Like, I can decide, no, look, I'm not gonna go be alone with him. I'm gonna be much more careful about this. We might get sexually intimate, he and I would have a conversation about this, all of those kinds of things. That's how I would protect myself. But I would be super crazy angry if a friend knew about this and didn't warn me.
Right. I think you need to take care of something in the chat.
I do. Okay, all done.
All right, you're becoming super speedy at this.
I know.
All right.
Okay, so I will say, the final comment I have here is, this is a terrible, terrible position to be in, to be the leader of a group in which there has been an accusation of this kind. And I say this because I have been there in a case of sexual assault. It was extremely difficult to figure out what happened. I made mistakes. I had to go back and correct them. And throughout, I tried really hard to be objective while protecting the people in the group. But it was a horrible, horrible experience, and there was no easy way out. And until things became really, really clear, it was gut-wrenching and horrible. And, like, dude, I hope that this never happens to you. That's pretty much all I can say about that.
Yep.
Okay, so take-home point?
What is your take-home point?
I'd say in this kind of case, don't just believe the accuser or the accused, but gather as much evidence as you can and see if you can come to a definitive or even a tentative conclusion. Then you can figure out what you ought to do and who you ought to warn.
Alrighty. Any follow-up questions?
I don't think so.
Yeah, I'm not really seeing any.
I think we need to skip the third question, which is unfortunate. Unless you're okay with going long.
I'm okay going long.
Okay, let's go long. The chat, what's going on in the chat, folks, which is a return of the horrible person saying horribly illegal, horrible things. Well, I don't know that the things that they're saying are illegal, but the acts that they are describing are horribly illegal. Anyway, so that's going on, but I will continue to manage that, and we will go long.
All right. So some of our listeners can't afford to contribute financially. Can they help out in some other way?
Yes. Any of you can help us promote the show by sharing our work on social media. You can share blog posts and upcoming events and posted podcasts. That helps us promote the show to a wider audience, and every share feels like a pat on the back. So thank you all who do that on a regular basis. I really appreciate that, and thank you who will start doing that in future.
Conga.
Oh, sorry. Completely forgot. God. Greg, I miss you, Greg.
Question 3, evaluating romantic prospects. How can I efficiently evaluate potential romantic prospects? When introduced to a person or out on a first or second date, it's often difficult to evaluate that person quickly and fairly as a potential romantic prospect. What should I look for? What questions should I ask? What kind of qualities, moral and psychological, should I regard as particularly important, for better or worse?
Yeah, so first of all, I would say that this kind of filtering is way more easy and way more efficient to do online than it is in person. With an online profile, you can get a snapshot of a person very quickly. You can find out tons about them without asking them a single question. And then you can, it's actually not super hard to be messaging back and forth and asking questions and then just say, sorry, not interested, right? I don't think we're a good match. So basically, I recommend that you use these online methods for searching out potential prospects, although much that we're going to say here applies to in-person contact too. So, but I definitely think that for this kind of efficient filtering, online is the way to go. Okay, so secondly, the basic procedure here is to decide on some basic filtering criteria. And there's sort of two issues that matter here. One is, what actually matters to you most? And secondly is, what is it easy for you to discern? And I'm going to use myself as an example in various respects, but your mileage may vary. Please do not think that what matters to me more should matter to you more. That's absolutely not the case. Basically, with the exception of moral issues and moral decency and basic moral character, all of this stuff is highly, highly optional and highly personal. Okay, so religion. This is one of the things that is easy and immediate and obvious, because pretty much all of these dating sites will list people's religious views. And so I'm interested in if somebody has answered a question about religion. Do they list a particular religion? And then what is their level of sort of seriousness about that? Right? It matters for me, certainly. I'm interested in dating people who are basically secular. And if somebody lists themselves as a Christian, I don't care what other qualities they have, that's pretty much out. Another issue. Another issue that's again very easy to discern and so helpful is attractiveness. Is this person cute in the face? Are they hot in the body? Right? It's okay to have preferences here. It's okay even to have very strong preferences and to look at somebody and go, sorry, like you're out because of this. Like, we're not a good match because of this. I really think that surface qualities matter for sexual attraction. So for romantic relationships, these things really matter. And oftentimes the care that a person invests in their body reveals their character and their values. So that says something about a person. For me, fitness and health and diet and stuff is a major hobby and major interest. So it's important to me in other respects. But I even think, look, innate qualities that people have no control over, things like height, these can be deal breakers, and reasonably so. That's okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of really interesting, there's an interesting psychological dimension to why you might prefer somebody who is a particular height, say, and maybe what that symbolizes to you or what kind of meaning that holds. But I wouldn't necessarily get too worked up over it, provided that the quality that you prefer is all of the things equal benign.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, if there's all kinds of things that would matter a heck of a lot more than that, or could matter a heck of a lot more than that. But, you know, look, it might just be that you're just not interested in dating somebody who's 6 inches shorter than you, if you're a woman, or you're not interested in dating somebody who's 6 inches taller than you, if you're a man. That's all right.
Wow. Way to go, sexist.
I know.
Before you continue, I think you need to deal with something in the chat.
Okay. Hang on. Oh, I didn't. Shoot, I forgot to take a screenshot of that one.
I got it.
Yay, thank you. Okay, another thing that matters are things like hobbies and interests. So somebody might be interested in sports, but are they interested in sports as a spectator or as a participant? Are they interested in fly fishing or lifting and CrossFit? These are things that are very different kinds of sports. Things like intellectual interests, other hobbies. And oftentimes here, what you want is a kind of contrast, but sometimes what you want is similarity. So it just, you know, notice, like, there's a difference between, oh, God, I would never wish to do that, and, oh, wow, that sounds kind of interesting. Maybe I'd like to try that. So
yep.
So that's important. Drug and alcohol use, these are important. Particularly in Colorado, we have a lot of people who are, quote-unquote, 420 friendly, or 420 users, and that refers to marijuana. And, you know, I have no objections to people smoking pot, and particularly people smoking pot on occasion, but that's something that if somebody is that kind, that it's important enough to them that they're going to list it in their profile, yeah, you know, that's an arm's length kind of, or it's like an orange flag for me, no thanks. Or just in general, somebody who's clearly, like, out partying on the weekends, right? That's what they like to do. Again, that's not my lifestyle. That doesn't suit me.
It's actually funny. That's one of my favorite fields on OkCupid. It's, you know, what are you likely doing on a Friday night? And I was just like, sleeping. It's nighttime.
Yeah. So there's lots of potential incompatibility there. Another issue that really matters is issues about sexual compatibility, things about frequency and variety and kinkiness. And if you're a fertile straight person, somebody's views on abortion, approach to STDs, all of those kinds of things can really matter. Those are hugely important. And particularly at a certain point, it's really important to have explicit conversations about these things, because particularly, I guess I would say, if you're outside of the sort of norm, it's really important to make sure that you're not just wasting your time with somebody who is more in the norm, and they're not interested in venturing out into the borderlands.
Right.
Another issue is relationship compatibility. Are you looking for casual sex, or are you looking for marriage? Right? Are you interested in strict monogamy, or are you open to polyamory? Do you have children? Do you want children? All of these kinds of things are really basic and really, really important. And again, these are things that show up in online dating profiles. And that's one of the reasons that that dating online is so useful, is because having those kind of conversations in person, like at a bar or at a party, can be really kind of super awkward.
Yeah. There's something you need to deal with in the chat.
Yep. Yep, yep. Okay. Another thing. Basic moral decency, particularly issues about honesty. And this is the problem with this. On the one hand, this should be number one on your list. On the other hand, this is extremely difficult to detect from either from a casual conversation with somebody or from an online profile. So that's really super important, but it's hard to detect. There are certainly red flags that one might notice. If somebody has not been upfront in certain ways with you, that's a really big deal. The thing that does come out more in online profiles is things like moral amplifiers. Is the person really driven and ambitious, or are they really laid back? Are they risk tolerant or risk averse? And so what you can do is look here and see, like, where do I want similarity and where do I want contrast? What's acceptable to me versus not? Another thing is conversational/grammatical skills. If you spell like a tween, if you cannot use full words, like, at least for me, that bugs. That's a problem. Also, if you cannot reply to open-ended questions in messages with more than a sentence or two, if you can't ask me an open-ended question, yeah, that's also a problem. So, you know, like, I'm looking for somebody with basic conversational skills, and that comes out fairly quickly in just a little bit of messaging. And, you know, I wonder, like, maybe that's unfair. Maybe they'd be better in person. But still, basic communication skills matter. Okay, hang on a second. More in the chat to deal with. You know what? Maybe I can. Hang on a second. Let me see if I can disable anything but Facebook logins and Twitter. And sorry, that would suck for the people who are using other kinds of logins, but allow guest logins. Oh, Jesus. Okay. Okay, this might actually help now that I think about it. Okay. So here we go. Back on again. Sorry, folks. Like, I really would like to have an uninterrupted episode. Okay. Issues about lifestyle compatibility. Is somebody really into travel or not? Are they really into eating out a whole lot? Personally, you know, like, This is one of the things that comes up for me because I have certain preferences around this. Love languages, right? There's a certain kind of way that people describe how they're like in relationships in some of these online sites that makes me want to puke. It's this like romantic way of talking about things, and yeah, like that clearly, like that's not of interest to me. That some women might adore that, not for me. So again, that can tell you something about how they would behave in the relationship that would be interesting and useful information. political views, I don't think these matter quite so much, but if somebody's profession is doing wrong, violating rights, then yeah, that's more of a problem. So
yeah, I think similar to the religion issue, because of course this is a strongly ideological matter. It's one thing if they have loosely, you know, bad political views that they aren't super serious about, but if they are strongly held and strongly idiotic, that could be problematic.
Right. Right. Because you'll not even want to talk about what they did at work, right? Or right. or how their job is going. You're going to be rooting for them to have a terrible time at their job. And that's
yeah.
that's not somebody you want to be.
I forget about even whether it's their job or not. It could be completely orthogonal to their career. The point is that if they are a crusader on Facebook for some really awful causes or for particularly bad political candidates, like that is really unacceptable. For example, I could ever be interested in someone who was even a passive admirer of Bernie Sanders. I don't think I could.
Yeah.
Like that's so incredibly idiotic that I just literally can't even.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So that's a pretty big list of things, criteria that you can judge people by. And these are things that are commonly issues for people that matter to people, but ultimately you have to figure out what qualities matter to you. And it's impossible for me to say what should matter most to you, apart from moral decency. Moral decency should matter to everybody. You're going to have to figure this out. You're going to have to decide. And that might not be really clear to you initially what should really matter. But one of the great things about perusing profiles and so on and messaging people and going on dates is that you actually do figure these things out. So experience really, really is helpful here.
Yeah. So how can a person be efficient in evaluating?
Yeah, so one, get that experience. Practice, practice, practice. Good judgment comes from experience. Experience comes from bad judgment. It's okay, you know, if that messaging thread goes wrong and you made a mistake, you went out on a date with a guy who clearly you should never, you know, never have bothered. That's all right. You know, lesson learned. Try again. I think you can certainly ask direct questions about what matters to you. You can be alert to evasions and other oddities. You can ask a person about things that come up that seem weird and wonky to you.
Yeah, and I think that you can definitely assess qualities as they become readily apparent to you. So physical attractiveness is really easily apparent, and therefore you can judge based on that first. Even if it's not the most important factor for you, if you know that there are various kinds of deal-breaking issues, or if someone is outside some kind of threshold, you know, don't waste your time or theirs.
Right, right. Another thing that's, I think, really important to do is be proactive. So message people that you're interested in. Don't wait for the other person to notice you and message you. This is particularly important for women. There's an interesting dynamic on online sites where particularly women get all kinds of horrible, creepy messages from men who should be spending their time doing something else with their lives. And so as a result of that, a lot of women just apparently don't respond to messages at all, even when they are not horribly creepy, even when they're nice and they're interesting and so on. And as a result of that, a lot of men have just decided, look, I'm not going to message. If you're interested in me, send me a message. And so women have to get over this waiting for him to come knock kind of approach. So get out there, start messaging. That's important in this particular case, given how the culture has sorted itself out.
I agree. And I would just say, make sure to temper that with the possibility of seeming desperate or overly zealous or
right
or what have you, because I've definitely been on the other end of that spectrum where I'm just messaging way too much and I'm showing way too much interest. And there is an understandable phenomenon of if you show far too much interest, it kind of comes off wrong and can turn other people off.
Right. Right.
Yeah. kind of moving on a little bit, I think another really great way to learn more about people is to ask OKCupid-like questions. So if you don't know about OKCupid or how that works, one of the ways in which, or one of the differentiating features of OKCupid is that they have this idea of match percentages. They kind of style themselves as being very data-driven in how they recommend people to you and how they suggest whether someone is going to be a good match for you or not. And they do this by having you answer all kinds of questions. And some of these are user-submitted, and I think some of them are actually developed by OKCupid. But the idea is that they're multiple choice. You answer the question, and other people answer the question too. But it's not just that you say what your answer is. You also specify, here are the answers that I would find acceptable by someone else, and here's how important it is to me that the other person answers in this way or in one of these ways. And on that basis, it can give you an idea of whether you're compatible with another person. So it's not necessarily that you have to answer the question in the same way, right? You might have a certain answer to something. You prefer someone give the opposite answer. But the point is that these can give you a lot of these kinds of questions, and what the actual substantive questions are, can give you a lot of really good clues about what kinds of topics you might bring up with other people, especially if you're not talking to them over OKCupid. You might get a good idea of what kind of matters or interests or whatever are interesting to talk about. They could be good icebreakers. It's just a good way to assess compatibility.
Right. Right. Another thing that I think is really important to do is to make yourself visible to others. So write up a profile that actually reflects who you are and what you want well, so that other people can filter through you. Because you don't always have to be the filter.
Yeah, and I would definitely advise in this context to write more about yourself. Don't talk about what you're looking for and what you like in other people in your profile, right? You need to know what you're looking for in other people, but it comes off as really judgy or moralizing or very limited if all you talk about is, this is what I'm looking for in other people. Right? When people read your profile, they want to know about you more directly. So talk about your interests. Talk about what you like to do. Talk about, you know, your favorite things. Talk about basically almost anything other than what you're looking for in other people, which is not to say you should totally ignore that, but just don't make that the main thrust or focus of your profile.
Yeah, and don't go negative. This is always there's sometimes where you can say things that are indicating your preferences in ways, you know, if you do that on occasion, that's not a problem. But there's some people whose profiles you read and it's just like one nasty thing about another of like, I don't want this and I don't want this and don't message me if you're like this, and you're like, dude, alrighty.
Say what you prefer, not what you don't prefer. An example of this, which is something that I use on my profile, is that I say that if you're interested in politics, I tend to get along better with people who are libertarian leaning. And, you know, I use the word libertarian because no one's going to understand the word objectivist. This is a lot more effective, I've found. In the context of a better, more positive, more self-centered profile in general. But it's a lot more effective than saying, I'm not interested in people who are on the left or on the right, or, you know, if you believe X, Y, or Z, we're not a match.
Right.
That's just, it's negative. And if you're the kind of person who's going to write a profile like that, you're probably also the kind of person that the other people, you know, aren't going to get along with anyway. So.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it does, the it's not just, I've seen this list of negative things and I match on three of them, so I'm not going to message this guy. It's that if you're the kind of person who would write a profile in that style, you're not the kind of person I want to hang out with.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think another important factor here, and this is, I think it's a big issue, but that isn't necessarily given a lot of attention because there's a certain amount of nuance here, is what their relationship is with their family. And I don't necessarily mean whether their relationship is close or strained, whether it's good or bad, but whether they, how they judge their family members, whether they act independently, whether they're the kind of person who is likely to make decisions in their life because they're worried about what their family might think or what their expectations are, or living up to what they think their family thinks is appropriate, or seeking their parents' approval versus being a truly independent person who, for example, might value the counsel of their family, but ultimately is going to make a decision based on what they rationally think is right. I've seen a lot of relationships go sideways because of this kind of even self-imposed familial influence.
Right.
And so getting a sense for what their relationship is like, what the nature of that relationship is, I think is really important. And again, right, this could be regardless of whether they have a really good and loving relationship with their family or whether it's strained and horrible or non-existent.
Right. Right. And I'd say the same digging can be done about, let's say, work issues. It doesn't matter so much what a person does, but why do they like what they do? What do they like about it? What do they dislike? Look for the things that reveal the kind of character that they bring to their work. I think this is the way to get at people's moral character and figure out whether they're decent, good people or not. And there's other kinds of questions of a similar kind. Like, it's a question of like, well, how do you decide things? How, like, why do you believe things? Right. These are more methodological questions, or questions that get at people's methodology. Those are oftentimes really revealing. And if people can't even articulate their reasons, if they regard these questions as like bizarre and incomprehensible, that also tells you something.
Right. But, you know, I would be careful about that, because not necessarily everybody is very philosophically oriented in this kind of explicit way.
Well, maybe that's a criteria.
Criterion. Maybe.
Oh, God, you're going to kill me after this for all the times I've used that in the wrongly.
Yeah, especially when you say biases instead of biases.
Oh,
my God. but no, I so for you and for me, that might be more or less important. You know, for me, it's a little bit more important that a person is, I don't mean for me more than for you necessarily, but it's more important for me that someone has a good basic approach, even if they don't necessarily know what that approach is in explicit terms.
There's a difference also between not knowing not yet being able to identify it, and regarding the question as stupid and senseless, and why would
agreed.
You ever think about that?
Completely, yeah. Completely agree. I think it's also interesting that this seems to further prove that basically all philosophic issues really end up rounding down to epistemology.
Yeah.
All right. So, what's your take home point?
My take home point. Hang on a second. I have something else to think about this episode. Good. I can't. Yeah. So, Blog Talk Radio Gal is telling us that we have less time, and I cannot actually fix this now. Okay, so take-home point is, by identifying what's important to you and seeking out that information, you can efficiently and effectively sort through romantic prospects to find the better ones. And so, folks, we're not going to have any time to do rapid-fire questions since we've run out of time here, and you might not even hear the conclusion, although it will get recorded. So, Conga?
Yep. Well, it's time for us to sign off from another episode of Philosophy in Action Radio. Thanks for listening. We hope you had a great time.
Well, I had a fantastic time, particularly once I fixed up the chat. Once again, thank you to our generous contributors. With every episode of Philosophy in Action Radio, we bring you ideas that engage the mind and help you live better. Plus, we introduce thousands of other listeners to the principles they need to live virtuous, happy, and free lives. We think that's hugely important, and we do depend on your support. So if you want to contribute, just go to philosophyinaction.com/support.
Remember, we welcome feedback on what we're doing well and what we could do better, too. Email all of that to diana@philosophyinaction.com.
If you want to see what's on tap in the next few weeks, just visit philosophyinaction.com/upcoming.
I'm Arthur Zay, and you can find me on Twitter as @LogicalArthur, and you can find me on Facebook. This show features Dr. Diana Brickell, and you can read her blog Noodle Food at philosophyinaction.com/blog. Please drop by to submit and vote on questions for upcoming shows, and then join us live here at the same time next week at Philosophy in Action.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.
Holy cats.
Hang on.